students and what happens in their world. There are many possible explanations. But I think it would make a serious error if we were to pretend that this is something that is happening only in the United States, because it isn't. Now, turning to the United States, it's important to notice, I think, that it's a very, very broad front revolt. Students are revolting about students are rebelling. Students are rebelling because professors are revolting. That's the way it goes. The student, there are many, many issues that may be involved in a particular instance, say, of student demands coupled with a threat to seize a building or something. It might be that they want an end to ROTC, or it might be that they are opposed to university rules governing dormitory life, and they feel universities should not function in loco parentis. They may be highly critical of accepted sexual morality, or they probably won't attack the university on this, but you will frequently find that these same students are very critical of the laws governing the use of psychedelic drugs. They tend to be very often supporters of black power goals and the black power movement. They are usually very hostile to the selective service system. They are eager to obtain student representation on curriculum committees. All goals like these have played a part in feeding the fire of student discontent and rebellion on campuses around the country. And I don't know what the common factor is in all of those. Maybe there is none. A third observation is that it seems to me, at least, that the civil rights movement has played a decisive role in the whole student revolt. For one thing, many of the students who have led the student revolts gained their experience in protesting social evils in the civil rights movement. Also, racially based issues have and are playing a key role in campus revolts. Blacks are making demands, and a large number of white students, sometimes the majority, are actively supporting these demands. And I suspect that on most campuses, even if the majority of the students and the majority of the faculty are not actively supporting the black demands, they are extremely sympathetic to them, which makes, of course, a very congenial climate for the blacks to present their demands. And then the third thing, which is important, I believe that the civil rights movement in the 1950s taught a lot of people, rightly or wrongly, that one could and should disobey unjust laws. When Martin Luther King and others began disobeying laws for the purpose of testing them in the courts, the idea sort of spread that one not only could, but perhaps should disobey a law that was unjust, and that meant a law that he felt to be unjust. And I think, too, that the conscience of America was, you know, whatever people might have said, whatever conservative newspaper editorialist might have said about Martin Luther King, I think almost all of America felt that he was too right to be just slapped down. I think that there was among us a great willingness to tolerate technical violations of the law, you know, because we felt so strongly that he was on the side of right, truth, and justice. But I've noticed that since that time, a lot of people sort of picked up the rhetoric of the civil rights movement, and you hear students now saying something like, if the university passes a regulation that you have to put your social security number down on your registration form, and you don't believe that's right, you have a duty to disobey the law. And so that anything you don't agree with becomes unjust, and you have a duty to fight it. Somewhat ideological. Then fourth, fifth, and sixth point, to make them quickly, it's obvious that the Vietnam War has provided inflammatory issues. This is seen by many of our students as a very moral issue. It has deeply divided the society, and of course it impinges sharply on the campus, where you have all kinds of young men desperately trying to stay out of the draft. Thank you. Fifth thing, as a college professor of many years now, I would certainly want to say that the failures of the college system are heavily to blame for what is going on the campuses. I think many of the student proposals for reformation of the universities and colleges are misguided, but they are not misdirected. The only thing where I think the students have erred seriously is in supposing that the enemy is the administration. This is not true. In my view, the enemy is the faculty, because they're the conservative ones. And final point, that my pony. There is a small but a growing number of students who see the university as nothing but a service center for the ruling classes, who want it destroyed, or if not destroyed, at least forced to change its goals radically. They want it turned into an institution that serves the interests of third world people. And these students tend to look for a solution to all of these ills in some kind of socialist transformation of society. These students, who are the real militants, are very bright, courageous, idealistic, hardworking, disciplined, and depending upon your point of view, of course, then, very dangerous. They're small. On most campuses, they probably are not represented at all. But on some campuses, I think San Francisco State is an outstanding example. They're very, very strong. And they have played a part in some of the rebellions at Cornell, at Harvard, at Columbia. The Columbia one was sort of directed, I should say. It wasn't originated by them, but it was directed by them. These, of course, are the people now that the Senate and the House are investigating, looking for a communist conspiracy. It's a rather waste of money to send Congress to investigate to see whether these people are communists, because all you have to do is read their literature. They say they're communists. Okay, I quit. Brother Senator.
Well, what?
Is it my turn?
Sure.
I teach at San Fernando Valley State College in California, which is in the state system. 2 years ago, we had, out of 14,000 students, 23 blacks, and that was the sum total. We have a large black community in our neighborhood, as well as a large Mexican community. I don't know how many Mexican students were on campus at that time, but it was relatively small, too. The faculty hearing of the unrest across the country, in which the black students were complaining about the injustice of the situation, decided that maybe our campus should make a positive approach to the situation and see what we can do about it. And under the state law, the school system could bring in 2% of the student enrollment of students who didn't meet the scholastic standards. That is, at least according to their high school grades. They may have the potential, but have been unable because of the economic situation or some other factor of coming to college. And so the faculty decided to make an approach to bring in black students, brown students, minority students, and minority white students, depending on the situation. And they actively started to recruit black students to come in to our school in order to try to promote and improve the situation that we had at our college. To get students to come out of this situation, they had to find somebody who was willing to go out in the ghetto and find people who would be willing to leave the ghetto to come to an awesome, freshly a lily white college and to come in under a situation where it was difficult to find transportation and so on. As it turned out, the only people that we could get to do this were really militant students to begin with, and naturally they recruited more militant students, and we ended up with some 200 to 300 students, which the law permitted us to bring in. When the semester started this past year, these students, they had brought them in the summertime to give them an initial program to give them some appreciation as to what college is and what teachers expect from them. And then the school began. This students soon found that the start of the program that we had for them really didn't meet their particular needs. That is, they live in an entirely different type of environment. Their values are different. The teachers were not entirely sympathetic with them coming in late or leaving early, and they didn't realize that they had to catch rides or they had difficulty getting in, and it became a very unhappy situation for the students themselves. Early in the semester, a black student on the football team, I don't know the exact story, but got involved with one of the assistant coaches who was trying to shove him off the field in order to prevent 12 men being on the field in a very exciting game. And this, at any rate, he got accused of being a racist, and the battles went back and forth as to black students demanding that he get fired immediately. And in the course of action, the students went over to the athletic office and marched in 40 strong and demanded that this man be removed immediately. And of course, the athletic director couldn't do this. It's the president's job. And so they marched him up to the president's office. And first thing you know, it got all out of hand, and we had 40 blacks with knife points. That is, they had knives, were holding the administration building on the fifth floor. SDS heard about it, came in and held the second floor. And there was a rather touchy situation in which the blacks were demanding immediately a black student program, that program be designed for them, that teachers be hired that were sympathetic with their program, that they had some 14 demands that I don't remember at the moment, but there were a list of things in which they wanted to happen right away. And of course, these things just don't happen right away. It takes time. Well, this is at least the situation there. Eventually, these people, well, the president, in order to get out of the situation where you've got people holding secretaries and everybody at knife point, agreed to the demands. And then the black students left. It looked like it was pretty dangerous. And of course, as soon as they left, then he said that anything in which you're required to sign something under a knife point isn't valid, and refused to do anything they demanded. The black students didn't realize that the faculty and everybody was making a very hard effort to get a program started, and their militant approach to us really set us back 6 months, because now we had all the legal fights involved and bringing these cases to court. And soon after this, the faculty tried to have a convocation in which the blacks and experts on the situation would be brought into campus. And they set up a date for this, and the black community heard about the program that was going to be presented, and they were sure that their views wouldn't be represented. And so in the black community, when they were having a meeting, some of the police force had infiltrated the meeting, and it appeared that they were going to descend on campus with helmets and clubs and disrupt the whole thing, and that our president wouldn't have a chance to prevent his views, and it would become a very violent sort of thing. So when the convocation date was set, the police recommended that it not be permitted to continue, and they declared the campus an unlawful area for assembly and did not allow any of the people to come on campus that day. This, of course, was just exactly what the SDS was looking for, and people, and they said, you can't declare this an unlawful assembly. We have a right to be on here. And so in the process, some 200 or 300 people were arrested for being told they should leave, and they wouldn't leave. This is a sort of the negative side of the picture. Now let me just talk a moment about the positive side that coming out of this, I think. Next year, I think we're going to bring in some 700 students. We're going to expand the program. Now we'll realize the mistakes that we've made. We're making a very conscious effort to recruit those students who are really interested in getting there for education. We're using the Black community and taking their advice, who they think would be, rather than using the Black militants as a recruiting force. The Black Studies program that's been set up is not as way out as you might expect. They're making a very conscious effort to try to get people to come in who will meet the needs of both the Mexican and the Black community in terms of giving them an education so that they understand their own people's problems. And they don't want them just to have Black history or Black sociology or Black this. They want to give them that, but they want them to get the training in the other courses so that they will come back into their own community and help their own people. And I think they are setting up a positive approach to this, but they want to give their own people a feeling of being a whole man. That is, they've been so long treated as if they were somehow one-fifth man, four-fifth something else, and they need this feeling of oneness, and this is what they're seeking anyway. So the Black Studies program that I've seen is not what I thought of what they were demanding, but something rather positive to meet their own people's needs, and they very desperately do need some help. This is all I have.
Thank you. To an extent, the university is like a church, and if it fits too cozily or is too comfortable, it's probably sick. And from that standpoint, maybe some of this is healthy, because truth develops from controversy. But there are some disturbing things about it. And I'm going to make some generalizations like Paul. I will try not to repeat the ones he said. I noticed that some of my generalizations are like his. But the first thing that impresses me about this whole thing is it recalls Busted's corollary to Agnes Allen's law, which is that everything is more complex than it seems to most people. Now, the tendency is to reduce complexities to a simple distinction between black and white. Or I should maybe use some other colors. But it leaves one with the uncomfortable feeling that important matters are being overlooked. We can say it, I think it was Will Rogers that said, the trouble ain't that people don't know anything. The trouble is that most of what they know ain't true. Hosea said it probably as well and shorter. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Another, I think, truth said by Eric Hoffer, and I think it is sort of generally true. No country is a good country for its young. Another thing we learned this afternoon at Carroll session, that we learned this morning at 8, and I'm making a pitch for these sessions, and because I learned something in all these sessions today, even about the sex of the oneself. And diversity is a great thing, you know. And but rebellion is contagious. You pointed out. I mean, it is. And cursing isn't going to correct it. And another, a very important thing, and Paul brought it out, about the global nature of this thing. And we must not underestimate its significance, or the extent of it. The historians can tell you, and I'm no historian, that governments, rulers, presidents, and leaders have been toppled because of student unrest. And we don't have to go back any further than President Ayub of Pakistan. Some of you remember Sigmund Rhee, And de Gaulle was certainly scarred a bit. And you historians can fill in the others. And the possibility does exist here in this country for a full-scale revolution. The risk of continuing to alienate the students from learning as well as from society are frightening. And the net result, I know, in the University of California system, I don't know if the University of California system will be the great university that it once was. I think most of the measures before the legislature right now, or have been, are punitive. And this means less support. And I'll get into some of these specifically in a moment. Now, what are the students protesting? Well, they're going to tell you in a little while, because we tend to generalize, and they'll probably get more specific. But I mean, they look around and they see poverty and the injustice. And Paul has brought out about the civil rights, the restrictions on freedom, and they cry for selfhood. I wear a button sort of for each lecture. Listen, says, I am a human being. Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. I mean, and this to an extent is part of the problem. At least in this country, where they have been counseled, they cry for selfhood. And the selfhood has been submerged in impersonal bureaucracy. We've gotten too big. And on another time, we'll discuss overpopulation. But there isn't enough room between buildings. I know there isn't at Berkeley, but they're taking a few of them down, I guess. Now, in my experience, there are other reasons. Now, when I came to the University of California system, I was in private industry for many years, although I had appointments at a couple of universities. But I didn't realize the full significance of the university, although I spent most of my life getting out of them. I thought, well, to be a university professor, you should find out, you know, how the big boys do it. So I went out and heard some lectures. Now, I heard some great lectures. There were some great teachers. But some of them I heard, the students would have been better off staying in bed. I mean, they were pretty lousy lectures. So poor teaching comes into it. Now, we try to correct this. I mean, we have evaluations, but evaluations just for the immediacy of the thing. And when all the students don't participate, it isn't any good. And some students, I mean, they're sort of a cross between a crocodile and an abalone, you know. And what do you get? I mean, it's a croc-a-bull, you know. but you know, they baloney, you know, a croc-a-baloney, yeah. In deference to the group here, yeah. You can, for a while at least, you know, you can get by with this. So you might get a pretty good rating. While another prof that's really tough, you know, and you get a pretty poor rating, you may flunk if you flunk him, you know. So I told them that when they make their ratings, they should put also down their grade. Of course, grades become another problem. And that's one of the problems. They'd rather some of them not be graded. Now the curriculum, you know, some of the curriculum, boy, I can understand, you know, the real gripes they have, because it really doesn't pertain to hardly anything that I can see. And so you try to change it, you know. Well, that's got to go before all kinds of committees, you know. And boy, I'll tell you, it takes a long time. I mean, when he said it, the faculty is a big problem. And it's a big problem for me. I go to the Senate meetings, you know, they're supposed to rule the university. And that's when I really got worried. When I the meetings of the Senate, huh? Talk about railroading. And there was poor support. Now, there's another thing. Now, this is a real legitimate gripe, I think. Now, when the new president for the University of California came in, he says, all right, you know, you've got to have a thing. And our thing is going to be the inner city, sort of, and urban crises. And one of the things they're going to do is to increase the number of disadvantaged students into the university. And so they did. We have an unusually good program, I think, at our university, like I think Larry's. And they have, I mean, some really outstanding students and faculty on this committee. And they're going out recruiting these in the high schools and out and around. And they go to a school and they say, well, have you got anybody like this? Somebody that would never consider the university for financial or other reasons. That it just isn't, you know, their cup of tea, or they just aren't in a position to do it. Do you have some of these? And in one school they went, well, the counselor didn't think they had any like this. Well, can we look at your records? There was a student there that was a Spanish-American. He was a 4-point, graduated to 4-point. That means a straight A. I mean, they didn't even know about him, sort of, you know? I mean, if it had been my child or yours, you know, he would have been, he made the front page, huh? He was one of 10 children of a peach picker. Well, now he's in the university on a free ride. Now, this, of course, changes the life of that family, and I hope for the better. And probably if there's one in the family, genetics obtaining, is that right, Barbara? I mean, there might be some others. But what did they find on the Negroes and the blacks? Well, they found out that many of those who were probably smart enough to get in the university were not prepared for the university. They were not prepared for the university because the counselor, being very pragmatic about the whole thing, saying, now listen, you're a bright boy. Your best bet is to go down there and take auto shop and welding. You know, leave off and you get a good job. And that was probably true. So they were not prepared to meet the standards of the university. Now we're doing something about that. We're taking them in and schooling them. I know in the School of Veterinary Medicine, we have Jesse Washington. Now, school comes hard for him, but the students and the faculty, you know, I mean, they're all down there helping him out, you know. I mean, he's a special case, and he's a great guy. And they're willing to put in this time on him and to help him out. Now we need more of this. And it's good for the students, too, because nobody learns more than the teacher. Huh? And so they're learning by doing this, and we have to do more of this. But when I think about this, I think, well, we're all hollering for black studies, you know. I mean, a lot of people are. But I think we ought to use some of this money to go back and prepare these people way back to meet the situation. Now, in our state, and the point of this whole thing is that what kind of money do we have for this? We asked the state government for $3 million for this. The governor cut it to $500,000. that means that $50,000 about it comes to the University of California, Davis, which is really, really not very much. And I'm sure if the story got to the people, that, I mean, a lot of them would have given up their $70 they got back from their, you know, that Ronnie insisted we get back for, I think it was for our taxes, yeah, on our property or something, you know. Because in California, I mean, the support for education, percentage-wise of income, is one of the lowest in the 13 Western states. It's probably 11. So the student, I mean, realizing this, working with it, he's got a legitimate, well, I guess I should say complaint. Now, another thing that really started off part of this, for example, at Berkeley, a lot of professors are anesthetized by grants. Now, I'm a kind of a wheel in the grantsmanship business. And I've been involved in it for many years. I'm not going to tell you how much you taxpayers are giving to me, but I am grateful for it. And so are my 1,100 beagles. That's beagle dogs. Now, and assorted other things, but a lot of, I mean, a lot of professors, you know, you got your grant, and for a while, you know, I mean, hey, get up when you're up, get me a grant, you know. I mean, and a lot of people had grants, I mean, what's the payoff in the University of California system? What was the payoff, huh? They counted the reprints, or they weighed them, you know. I mean, now and then they'd read them, the committees would read them, the secret committees, to evaluate you. But how do you evaluate teaching, you know? I mean, you can count reprints and you can weigh them, and then you can say some kind things about them, probably. About who knows about the teaching. Well, the students do, but a lot of them weren't talking. And then too many of them, and I've criticized this, and I'll hit this point tomorrow on the art of listening, you know. But I'll tell you tonight, for some of you who won't come, you know. I mean, I've been in classes, I've sat in classes out near the back, you know. And they let the prof get by with poor performance, you know. And he puts some charts up there on the board, and you can't see him from halfway down, you know. You sure can't see him up and back. You can't hear him, you know. The lights are down. And they just sort of act like they don't, like you don't give a damn, you know. Well, we'd like to have you, but maybe the lecture isn't worth it anyway. I don't know. Maybe you're studying something else. That's probably a good thing. Now, and there is a gap in communication, you know. It isn't so much the generation gap, I don't think, is sort of a gap between the various groups. There isn't enough faculty per student, sort of. I mean, I mean Jesus Christ, he figured this thing out a long time ago, you know. I mean, 12 is a pretty good number. Maybe you can get 11 good ones out of it, you know. I'm not doing quite that well, but that's a pretty good. I like about 8 or something like that. So you bring them up this way. In fact, I've suggested at the university that maybe each professor be assigned a certain number of students, not in his own field necessarily. And there's part of the problem, you know. We've got these sclerotic departments, and they build walls around departments. I mean, we talk, the administrators talk about an integrated curriculum, you know. You know, boy, they haven't convinced the departments of that yet, but you can read it in the books, in the catalogs. Some of them have attained it. I mean, there have been some real progress. In the University of California system at Davis, I mean, we do have an experimental college now. And there are, I think there have been some real, there has been some real progress. And don't fool yourself on the students. I mean, boy, you know, it's a real challenge to teach them. They're pretty bright, you know. And a lot of times I have to tell them, you know, I'm not young enough to have all the answers. now the students, you know, they've been raised on instant breakfast food, instant everything, you know. So you've got to have instant action. So they're naive, some of them, I think, and they're impatient. I mean, you know, wisdom, it takes some while to get it, I think. At least it doesn't come before 50. But they want the accumulated ills of a century corrected in a, it used to be a semester, now it's a quarter. Well, you have to be realistic. And you know, we run the system down there by regions, you know. Well, I and then the faculty on the campus. And the faculty, I mean, they, some of them, you know, they're not with it, and we have tenure, you know. I often wondered about tenure. I mean, it's a great thing. But you know, when you get to be a professor, and they have steps in professorship, and you know, when you get up there, you get enough to live off, you know. And a lot of people aren't that eager about it, you know. And they're, you know, it's, they retire before they're 65. And I think this is an unfortunate thing, and I think this was also disturbing to the students. That they are not putting in the effort that is required, because to teach well is an overwhelming thing, at least for me. Tenure provides a sanctuary for rigidity. Now, I think the answer is, I mean, there's probably a lot of answers to it, But I think one of them, I think Princeton's with it right now. And they're, instead of, I mean, I think they're moving towards a ruling body for the university that's made up of faculty, students, and maybe the townspeople, I mean the citizens. I mean, one of the big mistakes we make is that we ask the taxpayer for billions of dollars, but just leave us alone, you know. I mean, when he's putting that kind of money into it, he has a right to ask any question he wants. But he can't tell me what to teach. I don't think he has a right to tell me what to teach. I mean, to teach the truth as I see it. I mean, he cannot interfere with that. And you get the politics mixed up in it. But he has a right to know, a right to answer, ask these questions. And I think too long, I mean, I've associated with professors, they've never been out of town, you know? I mean, they don't know what's going on the outside. And I think part of the problem here, and certainly at the University of California system, I mean, when the governor says, boy, we got to get law and order on these campuses and put these students down, I mean, he gains another 50,000 votes, you know? I mean, because, and I think that's, there's something missing here, and they're not communicating. And I think the students and the professors must get out and tell you what we're doing that's good. Because what you read in the papers, and this is one of the big gaps, you mentioned the communication media. It's a big gap between what the communication media says and the truth. And that's one of our biggest gaps. And I mean, I know all of what these students are doing, how they're going out of town, how they're tutoring all these kids, and they're working over with the unfortunate kids in the towns adjoining us, and they go down to Mexico and help them. I mean, but do you read about this? No, you don't read about that, because it isn't as exciting as the People's Park. I'm sorry, I get on a soapbox when I get going here. I've already mentioned the increase in this population, and that, I mean, the population density, I think, feeds into this very strongly. And I think we will see more trouble, for example, at University of California, Davis, as we get along. And another problem, and I'm teeing off on the faculty here, it's a kind of a self-criticism kind of a thing. We're sidewalk superintendents, you know. Say, boy, you ought to do it that way, you know. I mean, you see these fellows standing watching, you know. Boy, you got to do it that way without getting in there and doing something about it to correct it. And we're raising the students to be sidewalk superintendents, to be critics, and not constructive critics that get in where the action is. And another thing, I mean, characteristic of this age, and I think we're teaching the students this too, we refuse to accept the responsibility for our actions. To say, I was wrong, and I'll take my medicine. We have a law school there too, and I heard some students, because I was lecturing, and we don't have enough room, and there's another complaint of the students. I mean, we had classrooms where it wasn't room in the classroom for all the students. So they had to sit out in the aisles and some of them out in the hall. So I had to move over to the law building. I was out in the hallway listening to students, you know, with my good ear. And they were talking about, you know, how to win the case. You know, if you do this and this, you know, then they weren't concerned with the truth, you know, and what was right here. It was how to win the case. And there's something wrong with that. Now, there's another thing that, and I hope that I incite somebody to really react on this. But now, we say, well, who's going to bring it down? Are the few in the SDS going to bring it down? I say that it is the non-radical student, receptive to new ideas and sensitive to the changing world around him, who has the power to bring the house down. At the Berkeley, the big Berkeley thing in 64, a student, a pre-law student, he was on his way, it was Sunday morning, he was on his way from Sunday school to the library, and a journalist stopped him. And he courteously consented to an interview. And he said that he was not on the sit-in in Sproul Hall. And because he wasn't about to, you know, get, he wanted to get in law school. But he parted with these words. He said that if the Board of Regents do not change the policy toward free speech and assembly, that he would. And if this is the view of this, which is the majority, now that's when you get into trouble. Because that's what can really change it, when you get this many doing it. But I feel very strongly, and I'm with Luther here, as Carol said, that we must do it with tongue alone and not with swords. Because it has been my observation from the combat infantry that when you build barricades, they are usually attacked and overcome by force. And there must be a better way. Now the church must be very much involved in this. I mean, we have the Maoist Synod, the Marxists, the Castrites, and all kinds of other shades. And the church better get in there. They better get in there, and not only as a critic, but as a revolutionary too. But I say as a critic because any revolution can be given to arrogance and to corrupt the goals, and the church better straighten them out. Now, I think that's enough for now. I used more than 10 minutes, I'm sorry. Well, I'm not really sorry, no. But you got to be honest with me. Sure, I think so.
All right. Your turn.
Two questions, and I'd like to direct them to Larry. You used the term militant, black militants, and the militant approach throughout. And I'm not familiar with the San Fernando situation, but I'd like you to explain your conception of militant. And the second question, you said that you're talking about the program by which 200 to 300 blacks last year were at the university, and you were going to expand this, it was going to be expanded to 700 next year, and you said that you hoped that these 700 would be more interested in really want an education. I'd like to know how you determine which group, the 200 to 300 group or the 700 group. I'd like to know which group, how you can determine which group really wants the education.
I think your points are well taken. I think the students that came there, who I consider militants, were not willing to work through the structure that existed. And didn't realize that the faculty was in control rather than administration. And it's the faculty that's the problem. Administration is quite willing to go along with what the students wanted. It was the faculty that was against it. But the black militants that I was considering as militants were more interested in tearing down the structure than rather than working in a committee and working with the faculty talking about the problem. And perhaps the students that we're looking for now is somebody who is willing to work with the faculty and sit down and work things out in sort of a communication. And it's the people who want to tear down the structure that I think that they're trying to avoid, and this is what I'm saying in terms of the black militant. Now maybe I'm not using it correctly. Does this answer your question or not?
Yeah, it was bothering me. It seemed that every every black on the university, you want to label militant, I just want to be sure.
No, this is not the case at all. We're looking for people who really want an education, or are not there just to tear down the structure. I think we've got some very fine black people there. I'm really very encouraged about it. And they're not making any effort to be constructive, and this, we can't have a university if they're going to tear it down. This is what I'm worried about.
Well, I should say that the black, I mean, it's a tough time to be black, you know. I know in our university, because two of the outstanding leaders on our campus among the students are black, and they really, I mean, they're going to go places, they're going places, and they're working, I think, within the structure, and they're getting things done. But they have been attacked. I mean some the so-called moderate blacks on the campus. I mean, some so-called militant blacks, by his definition, those that are bent on destruction of the establishment, have come up and I mean, manually beat them up and said, boy, get in there and burn her down, you know? And it's a tough time. I mean, they're under a lot of pressure to really get in there and stir things up in a tough sort of way. Now, you bring up another very good question, and that is, how do you pick out the one that's going to go, you know? Because if you get them into the situation and they do not succeed, you know, I mean, if they go down to tools, you know, it's sometimes almost worse than if you hadn't made the trip. And this is a very hard thing. And we're going to have a lot of problems, because right now in the University of California system, everybody that up till now has been able to get into the system that met certain requirements will not be able to get into the system. And those that do not get into the system and say, well, those people are not meeting the requirements, and I am not at the university because he has my place. And there's going to be backlash to this.
Well, the pressures are U.S. faculty members and maybe your school administration doing to get these professors to get with us that are retiring at 50 but staying on at 65 on the staff. What can we do about this?
Well, during my short tenure there, not quite 4 years, I know of only two professors that have gone out the front gate, sort of, from the standpoint of appearing before privilege and tenure. I think both of them were for falsification of data, or I mean, presenting the publishing data that was made up. Well, this is a big system, of course. It's pretty hard to get rid of a tenured professor. I mean, we're going to face it in a department I'm familiar with and have some affiliation, because he is not able to teach. And but it's a pretty tough thing to get rid of a professor who has tenure. Now, there were some reasons in the early days to establish tenure. I should say that a professor comes up for evaluation, I think every 2 years, and probably there are a couple of things that have happened. I mean, he may not be promoted, but he may still make a pretty handsome salary. They're pretty good. Our salaries aren't as good as a lot of other schools, but. Or he may be reclassified. I was responsible in a case like this for one of my associates, where he was. I mean, he didn't fit the classification, and it did cause a reduction. But this is a hard. I mean, it's a pretty hard route to go. So I guess to answer your question, it's a tough situation.
No answer. It's been real you're really not doing too much yet. Maybe we have to change the law, the tenure law?
Well, I'm not so sure if we shouldn't, you know. I mean, and this will be a real fight.
Well, I'm interested in it mainly because I can sort all the way down to the kindergarten teacher. I've got some girls on my staff that, and the staff and school system I'm familiar with that I know they're just waiting, biding out their time, and some school administrators too. And but our hands are tied. You've got to have moral, you've got to get a moral case of proving.
They have to assault the president's daughter.
It's going to be, I think anybody who's familiar with tenure systems and the strength of a tenure system and the consequences for any college or university that tried to undermine the tenure system realizes that this is a very, very slow battle. And I'm sure that within our lifetimes, about all we could hope for is to get rid of some of the worst cases, but we still wouldn't. I mean, we could get rid of the people who are, you know, not showing up at all for class. But we couldn't do much in this way, I think, to get more inspired teaching. I'm more and more persuaded that the students have a large role to play in this. I think that the American college university system evolved in a very strange way into, and there's an excellent book on this, the one by Reisman and... What's that?
Well, he's second author.
Yeah, he's the other guy.
He's at Harvard.
Yeah, what's the other guy's name? The Academic Revolution.
That's right.
Anyway, this book contains an excellent history of the American college university system. But it seems to me that it evolved into a kind of, a place where children of the middle classes and upper classes spent 4 years, perhaps acquiring useful knowledge, perhaps not. Anyway, having a fairly good time. But they had to, since we don't believe that somebody should just have a good time, they also had to go to boring classes and pass somewhat difficult tests and read dull books and meet certain minimum standards. And for a long time, most students, I think, have felt that college was not supposed to be exciting or really worthwhile, except that it did give you the union card at the end. I think the students sort of accepted this system. They griped and Jones is dull, but, you know, it's kind of what you expect. They were sort of grateful for that rare teacher who would excite the student and seem to say something worthwhile. But that is changing. The students have changed. They, for complicated reasons that I don't begin to understand, students are demanding something. The big word is relevant. There's very rarely any object to that. When they say it has to be relevant. You say, relevant to what? And they don't know, but they want it relevant. Well, if students would begin being dissatisfied in the classroom with particular things that are going on, if they would have the guts to say, why are you standing up there reading this stuff to us? Isn't there some place where we can read it for ourselves? Why did you pick these books out? And I don't mean that students should get, you know, cantankerous and deliberately try to irritate the professor, but there are lots of things that professors do because they've never thought about it, or because they're lazy, or because they're convinced that the students don't really care that much anyway. You know, it's terribly discouraging to work up something that you really think is great and come in, you have the same blah looks back there that you had when you weren't prepared. And this is about the only place where I see much hope for reform in the near future. If students will take seriously their obligations as collaborators in the educational task.
Now, and it's having an effect, boy. I'll give you some examples. It's Christopher Jennings.
Christopher Jennings, yeah. That's
right. I'll tell you an interesting story about Reisman. Reisman's from Harvard. Any Harvard men here? Anyway, I was just about the time of the Harvard... thing, you know. I was in Washington, and when I go to Washington, I usually have a breakfast with a good friend of mine who's one of the associate commissioners of education. And he had recently been talking to Reisman, you know, and Reisman was telling him how, you know, why this will never happen at Harvard, you know. I mean, they'll never have this at Harvard, you know. And it just happened that morning when we had breakfast. He says, I'm going to have to call him up. you know, and have a talk with him. Hey, what did you tell me the other day, you know? And I told him it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of guys.
Of course, you've got a little problem with kindergarten, you know? I mean, they're not going to organize so much against the We got at a university. I mean, a professor in the department I serve. I mean, he was brought in as chairman of the department, you know. I mean, a senior professor. And he isn't teaching anymore. Why? Because the student said he better not teach anymore, you know. Or Dr. Fuller here. I mean, he remembers somebody in microbiology, huh? I mean, he's no longer teaching either. Because I'm sure probably the next day that this particular one could have gone there, nobody would have been in class. Huh? And that's kind of embarrassing. speak of a black power, there's student power, you know. But don't misuse it.
This came about, a lot of it, because of an evaluation system that we started, and just a written evaluation system, and it was a real productive thing. There's sort of a campus-wide evaluation system, too, of courses. They published a book that he ordered. But this isn't really looked on too heavily, I don't think, by the faculty. They look at it...
Oh, you better believe it. Some of them cry when they read it.
But, I mean, there's not too much action based on that. In the veterinary school, there is a lot of action based on it.
But some of them, you know, aren't helpful. And I tell them, boy... I mean, all of you should contribute. I mean, I got one. I'm involved in one course where a lot of people teach it, you know. And one of the comments was, at least he's funny, you know. Well, that's sure no help, you know. Well, you see, now go ahead. Yeah, I know it. I proposed a system of evaluation that should be done not only at the end of the course, it probably should be done every course, I'm not sure. In the Army, you know, and you can say what you want about the Army, and I know what some of you people are saying about the Army. I'm in research and development. And I got called last year, and year before, to Caltech. They had a research and development symposium. And every lecture you give is evaluated right when you finish it. I mean, you get the results of it, you know, right there. So you know how you did. I mean, you were tested, essentially. And maybe that's a pretty good idea. But I propose that you not only do it at the end of the course, but if you're a first year student, you do it again, say, and maybe you pick out 10 or what, I don't know how, you know, a good sampling of the class, and then you have that student, even if you have to pay him, you know, saying 3 years later or 2 years later, he again evaluates that course in relation to what he's had at this stage, and then again, like for medicine or veterinary medicine, you evaluate it after you get out, you know. If you can remember it, you know. In many cases, you won't remember you had it. But maybe that's significant, too. But this measurement is a very difficult thing. I mean, when you set yourself on judging another, evaluating another, that's one of the toughest jobs I do. I mean, to evaluate a person. But one of the unfortunate things that happens, I mean... The unhappiest people I know are the ones that are out of their group. They're in a position that they can't handle. I mean, and one of the toughest things I've had to do to this student who had been through it recently,
I mean, you are not cut out for a PhD, you know? I mean, after he's gone down the route quite a ways. I mean, and we do it to our children, don't we? I mean, boy, you're going to be a great swimmer. He doesn't like to swim, but boy, you're going to make him a great swimmer, you know, when he should be out there running or something like this. But you're going to make him into something, you know. And in General Electric Company, where I worked for many years, I mean, the misfits, you know, I mean, they were put in a position that they couldn't handle, and they're not the most unhappy people in the world.
May I ask?
Yes, very definitely. I don't know what will happen. I would predict that the anarchist wing of the SDS will sort of dissolve. They'll be around, and these people will be available for some causes, but being anarchists, they won't be very well organized. The Progressive Labor Party, I think, is going to gradually die out, and I suspect that the most effective of their members will. They are being gradually converted to the Maoist position. And the Maoists are very well organized, in close contact with one another. They have, what do they call them, not cells.
Communes.
Communes, yeah, communes. They're engaged in spirited dialogue, exchanging letters and articles, and their experiences, their organizing programs. And I think this will be the principal shoot that emerges from the dissolved SDS. And they of course, have worked closely with SNCC and with the Black Panthers. And, well, the third world group means different things in different places. And it's, in most parts of the country, I don't think third world liberation fronts are very well organized. But probably where they do come into existence, they will be controlled by the Maoist wing of the SDS, or the Black Panthers, if there's a strong Black Panther group. If the Black Panthers, in turn, don't get torn apart by internal dissension now.
Surprised me in the article in the New York Times, which is a leaflet from Liberation, was on a small group, really. The SDS is, what is it, 7,500 that's actually active, not card carrying, subscribers to the magazine, and the left magazine. And that little group is turned upside down, you know. Well, I guess we all try to apply.
Well, they're a small group, but it's obvious that there are an awful lot of people who are sympathetic to at least some portion of their program. In the Harvard case, I mean, what caused the majority of the Harvard students to actively support the SDS? Well, I guess it was the excessive use of police force in clearing the campus. But that's right. After all, police have been using excessive force for a long time. There's something radically wrong with our society, with the students. I don't know, but there's a great danger that we say there's so few SDS people, you know, just a small little group. If we can club them, put them in jail or something, we'll solve all our problems. I mean, obviously, it's not the case.
No, I mean the opposite, though. I mean, I think what I think is it's a small group, but what a tremendous amount of energy. And we always talk about the Christian church as being a minority, and of course we can't expect to do so much because it's just a little group. And that's really odd against it. I just feel like they are a continual kind of they kind of beat me with a wall of their ability to just like take a finger to destroy the ministry of trust.
Well, Paul,
said about the Negroes, that there's only a very few militants, but all the Negroes are angry. I think it's the same thing with the youth. There's a lot, not very many SDS members, but there's a lot of youth who want to change. Mm-hmm. They're sympathetic to the SDS, even though they don't agree with what they do. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to speak to one other aspect of the problem that hasn't been mentioned. That's from my own personal view as a faculty member. I'm supposedly hired for a 12 contact hour with the school, and I kept track of my time, which was involved in school work, and some weeks during the year it runs over 100 hours a week in terms of committees, grading papers at night, this sort of thing. And then to bring in the black students, and if they don't show up in class, they're hurt because I haven't given them personal attention and called them on the phone and asked them why they didn't come that day and find out the problems that they have. And it just turns out that I just don't have enough time to give these people individual attention that I should. It's partly the load, and it's partly the number of students that I have to teach in class. And the way the system is going, each year I have to teach more and more, and the economics of the situation are just forcing me to the point where I can't do my job like I want to do it. And this is part of the whole problem too, I think. There just isn't enough time for me to give the intention that I need to do to the sort of students that we're going to have to help.
May I ask a question somewhat in that line? Is it true that much of the rebellion and revolution is also fostered by young faculty members who are after the destruction of the institution or something of that nature? Is that true?
You want to address this question?
Well, I mean, I think they're...
the Berkeley situation.
The schools that I know well, and not through the newspaper, I find that there are not very many young faculty who are actively fomenting, or fomenting, I guess, anything. I've read things, but I haven't seen it myself. There are certainly, I think it's certain that there is more support for radical student demands among young faculty than older faculty. And on large schools, there's also this group, what are they, faculty or graduate students? In a sort of a never-never land, the graduate assistants, the people on fellowship, they will frequently be cadres of the revolution. They frequently feel themselves to be a persecuted minority. The notion, which seems to be widespread in some circles, that the faculty is responsible for planting revolutionary ideas in student heads and organizing student rebellion, on all the campuses that I know anything about, this is not true.
I know a couple of faculty members on ours that are older I'm suspect of them because, I mean, they're sort of demagogues, you know. And I would expect some of these more so than a young assistant professor. In our system, you see, you don't really have tenure. The big push is to make tenure when you associate professors, you see. So he's like this pre-law student I told you about, you know. I mean, are you really going to take the chance, you know? So this would discourage to an extent. But in the Berkeley situation, there were several young people involved, but there were a lot of them were TAs, you see, or graduate students.
What is a TA?
Teaching assistant. I'm sorry, teaching assistant.
Now, Hayakawa said that that's where this was all fomenting, from the professors who thought they ought to be at Harvard and Yale and found themselves at San Francisco State and passed this discontent on down to their students. And the students have to follow the line if they're going to major in this man's course. And then he in turn passes them on in graduate school to other men of like ilk. And they breed, and Hayakawa said these are the hardest to uncover because the students won't tell on them. You know, they can't if they want to pass. And they build little cliques with great thick walls, and it just perpetuates itself.
Yeah, well, he's got, Hayakawa's got a tough problem there.
and they think they got a tough problem with Hayakawa too. I should say the state college system in California, it's really unfortunate because they do get short shrift, you know. I mean, they don't get hardly any time for research, and the facilities for it, they're not paid as well, yet they do a better job of teaching, I think, than some of the students come to university, you know. I've talked to someone and said, well, we have better instruction over at state college, you know. Because they're professional teachers, you know, and so they feel so some of the discontent will spread. Now, also, he's sort of unlucky there, because I was at lunch with Rosemary Ruther, who's on the staff here in Washington. I think it was last December or something, and she says, hey, what's going with those crazy guys out in San Francisco? You know, they hired a guy. We think we got rid of a psychotic, we got rid of a coward here. And he was one of the wheels down there in this, you know. Howard University, Colored University. There's a big competition, and I'll let you know, there's a big competition now, not only for bright black students. I mean, we can't compete with Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Johns Hopkins, some of these schools that are out there actually recruiting bright blacks. I mean, if you're a bright black today, you got a free ride in the best universities in this country. Mm-hmm. Or if you're an outstanding black instructor or professor. I mean, boy, we're actively recruiting. I mean, it's one of the big complaints the University of California is having. Where are all the black teachers? I mean, they're all jealous of me because one of my veterinarian associates is a black. A pretty girl, too. And it's very impressive, you know, because I always use her for... We have a fairly large laboratory, and it isn't everybody, as I say, that has 1,100 beagles. A lot of people like to come and see them. I never let them pet them or get close to them, but they want to see them, and they want to see the laboratory. And as an atomic energy installation, it's part of our job to tell the taxpayer about this. And it's interesting, you see, I bring the people in, if I'm there to give the orientation to these, say, high school youngsters, you know, or something. And then I'll give him a little orientation. I'll say, now, Dr. Hosean, who's a pretty black girl, will take you for a tour, you know. And I see she's just come in the back door now, you know. And invariably, you see, there's quite a few black students among this group, you know. And they turn around and look back there, and they do a double take, you know, like this, you know. And I'm sure it has, I think, a great effect on the colored student there, you know. And just, boy, you know, she made it, you know. She couldn't make it in Texas. I mean, she couldn't get into the university in the veterinary school there.
She made it on her looks?
No, she didn't. She had to pass. I mean, she couldn't make it at Texas A&M because she was black. She couldn't get into veterinary school. Yes.
How about the complaint from the students that too many of the heads of the department or the professors and so forth are spending their time writing books and are allowing the teaching assistants to conduct the classes all the way, and they never have any contact with the man who is really supposed to be teaching?
In many cases, this complaint is legitimate. This was one of the reasons given in the initial Berkeley revolts. I mean, you've got all these Nobel Prize winners down here, and they have a corner on some of them, you know. Where are they? Well, the truth of the matter is, some of them are better off not having them, you know. I mean, because some of them are lousy teachers, you know, except in a graduate situation. I mean, boy, I mean, don't fight it, you know. I mean, maybe some of the TAs are better instructors. Because, there are not a large number of good teachers, you know.
That's what I was waiting for somebody to say.
They just aren't very many, huh?
I think on the other side of the coin, though, is the good teacher who is, well, a man involved indirectly in a struggle, who's in an effort to keep a good instructor in on a faculty when his existence was threatened because he was published.
No, there is a move more towards that now. And right now in the evaluation of the University of California system, and I know on the secret committees I sit in on, where a person is up for promotion or something. I mean, I insist, you know, that, I mean, all right, 60% of what he's supposed to be doing is teaching, you know? So he better, you know, that better count something. And it should, and I will say for our university and our school, I mean, even the dean of the School of Veterinary Medicine helps teach some class. He insists on it. And I don't know any chairman that doesn't teach. And I think this is true in the School of Medicine. And but some of the younger professors, some of the professors are better teachers. But there again, there's something wrong with the system in a way. Because, I mean, we're still turning out PhDs without any instruction, or very little instruction, as to how to teach and how to give tests. Isn't that right?
Many of them don't want to teach.
Yeah, that's
PhD
right.
Was originally a research degree. And if you look at PhD programs, most of them don't make any sense if they're thought of as preparation for college or high school teaching. They just don't. They almost incapacitate a person for teaching. They narrow him down. They teach him so much about so little.
When they draft the juice, it's just a process.
Yeah.
Come out of it quick.
But there's a real danger. It was something you said. I think we can mislead ourselves. We talk about, well, why don't colleges and universities reward the good teachers, keep them, promote them, pay them more money? That's not really going to solve much. Because that just means that this university will keep the good teacher instead of his going somewhere else. Good teachers don't go out of teaching because they're not getting paid much money. They stay in teaching anyway. If University X doesn't pay them a whole lot or doesn't promote them, they'll go on to College Y. They'll still be teaching.
What I was talking about, though, was not a person who was wanting to leave, a person who was struggling not to leave, being booted.
Well, but where will he go when he's booted? Where will he go? He'll go into some other college and teach. I think we often make the mistake of supposing that we will get better service if we pay people better. This is sometimes true and sometimes not. We have to first decide what makes a good teacher and focus on increasing the supply. If we just start, well, it's like with the blacks now. We'll say, well, go out and get more black students or go out and get more black teachers. Well, there's just so many around, as it turns out. And if you start paying more, that's not going to solve it. It means they're all going to wind up at Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, and Johns Hopkins, who can bid the highest. We've got to worry about increasing the supply of black teachers and black students. Our students at SMU this year, our black students, demanded that in September we have 500 black students in that university. They said black people make up 10% of the population, they only make up 10% of the undergraduate student body at SMU. Well, we couldn't get 500 black students in SMU if we used machine guns. We could give them full tuition, board and room, spending money, and threatened to shoot them if they didn't come, and we would still wind up with about 150, because Harvard's got bigger machine guns, more machine
guns. Let me throw in a psychological pitch here, and see how you react to this. That we've been talking about this all from a college student point of view, but you have to say, well, how did they get this way? And it doesn't just start in college, and it starts much earlier. And at our church in Southern California, about 2 months ago, we had a family life conference. And one night we had a session which was titled "Teenagers Talk Back." It was supposed to be bridging the generation gap deal. And there was a panel of four from the local high school, which is upper middle class area, affluent society kind of thing. And they were all very articulate. They all spoke out very well. And when they were through giving their presentations,
One of the fathers in the audience spoke up and he said, how do you on the panel, what do you see as the main reason for the big conflict between parents and students today? And this one fellow, who I found out later was the student body president of his high school, he stood up and just right out he said, well, I think that there's only one main reason, and this is because of the difference in values between parents and students today. And it was, I think, significant to have him put it in those terms, although he wasn't saying anything really profound, but that he looked at it from this point of view too. But then I was moderating this thing, and I was trying to find out what he meant by this. Okay, so what do you mean? And then later on I tried to get each of the panel to hammer out what they meant by values. And they put a list of six things on the board, and yet they couldn't really agree among themselves on the six. And they only agreed on one of the six among themselves. And the one they agreed on was the one, the freedom to be an individual. And it seems to me that this is really at the heart of a lot of the whole student uprising. The freedom to be an individual, to have their say, and to really to be heard as a separate individual. So that on each campus, each college campus, the expression the revolt takes is very different, you know, the issues, the things they want. They really, basically, really want to be heard. And in this church group itself, it was very difficult for them to be heard. You know, they were the focus, they were the program this night, and yet as soon as they would start to say something, all the adults in the audience wanted to fight with them instead of listen to them. And they wanted to talk back to them, put them down! And then, you know, the kids really kind of felt overwhelmed, but power to them, they hung in there and tried to really have their say. But you could just see very easily why they would get very angry, why they would be uptight. So that when they get to college, they got a little more guts, a little more strength, and it's starting to come out in a little more ways, a little more loud ways. Except that I think we've really trained them to do this. As from infancy, we say, well, we don't want you to be just normal, we want you to be a leader, we want you to be successful, so, you know, go to it. So we taught them pretty well. And now they're going to it. And the shape this takes, though, would vary from college to college. And we have idealistically said we want blacks to be equal and all this, and so now blacks are saying, okay, we get the message, and, you know, we want to be equal. And again, this seems to me to be what's going on. So then when we as adults try to think logically about, you know, just how can we meet these demands and how can we be fair and all this, they are saying this much more as an expression of their own identity and in hammering out an identity crisis within themselves. Well, I'd like to have you react to this.
Why don't you ask some of the people upstairs and the younger, if they're still around, the younger ones. I'd like to hear their reaction to that. Huh?
Didn't like that.
I don't dig, I don't know, I didn't catch the point. What I don't like here, is what you're doing is we're trying to find out the student disorder and we keep throwing darts at the board and hitting the teachers. Which is not, maybe it's not a student problem, it's a teacher problem. So the problem with the youth is adult. And I don't know, but if you get, you talk to these kids, then you're a clinical psychologist, right? As Carol Taylor said. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's just because you're a clinical psychologist, you want to know about, you know, why. And I don't, you know.
That's the wrong question.
Maybe. I think so. And because the kids want to be individuals. And if you ask kids why, so they classify you.
That's the reason for asking why, so they could be classified.
I kind of agree with what you say, asking why. And, you know, I probably feel quite a bit like he does, but I think it's important to ask why with anything. When you see something that you do approve or that you don't approve of, ask why. And keep asking why. Keep stripping it down until it gets so simple you actually find the real reason. Or if there are various reasons, to find the various reasons. And just to keep understanding things clearer. So that I think that's the basic reason to alleviate problems, is just to strip them down so you can understand them and you can remedy this thing in the future. And through clinical psychology or sociology, or anthropology, or whatever the case may be, economics or anything.
Would you apply that to everything then? To ask why on everything?
I can say yes, and then you probably find something I disagree with.
Well, I've been doing this all my life, and I've come to a place where some things don't have an answer.
That's keep long. Searching.
Yeah, I know. I know it doesn't make you give up, but I mean, frustrating.
I mean, don't come to an answer before if there's still something you don't know.
True.
There's still some variable that you haven't found. Don't say, well, I'll ignore that and I'll take what I have now and call that the truth.
I had a good solution. I thought maybe we could just let the scholars tell us what was right or why.
Can you really separate the whole issue of student revolt from the whole patterns of the trends of our society and this real massive rebellion that's going on? I look at it in the area of youth, that the kids have dropped out of families because they've been free to do that. They dropped out of church because they've been free to. The reason they haven't dropped out of high school, the law says they've got to stay in. And it seems like the only way they're going to make it in this wonderful land of ours is go through college, maybe, you know, and you'll make it. So they're going to try and swing it that way. But I think there's a fight against the power structures and institutions as a whole. They don't sit around and bitch about churches like they do around schools, so they don't give a damn, you know? They just leave it.
So I think the
student revolt is an indication of our whole trend, that we're moving in a direction that we're not being open as a society to permitting, you know, a real freedom of expression. And it's been very inhibiting. And I think when I first went to California in 1962, I was really enthralled because, so many wonderful things were happening. And the pendulum swung down to the point, man, I'm panicking. It's really frightening. This idea that Dr. Buston mentioned earlier, that Berkeley is too big. The regents right now are considering breaking it down at a small college level, community colleges. But their motives are punitive. Not rehabilitation of the university, but punitive. We can control the students better that way. Instead of having them all one big bunch, we get them in little cloisters, you know, they like mom. But I think this the student revolt is just a symptom again of what's happening in our society. And the revolution is here, man. I don't know. It's armed already. It's not a matter of it's coming, it's here. Fighting in the street, there's bombs, there's killings. Now we're talking about it coming, we're in it.
In what?
A revolution. Armed revolution.
How do you see that?
I see it in the newspaper. I see it in my hometown. I see it on television. There's fighting going on. There's a revolution. Armed warfare. Guerrilla warfare. And we see it on both sides, not just from the unhappy souls wandering around looking for their place, but we see it, you know, from tear gas sent to people's parking on helicopters. That is a revolution. I don't know what is. What do you want to call it, from which definition? I don't know.
Didn't we say earlier this evening, do we accept everything we read in the newspaper, or don't you think there might be today a little bit of tabloid sensationalism?
Boy, it's the truth, boy. You better believe it's the truth.
Well, I'll tell you this. I think the newspapers haven't said some of the things that you wouldn't even believe have happened.
The newspapers have made a nice story out of it. They haven't even said what goes on. And it's 10 times worse than what the newspapers say.
Right. Of course, Jay, sometimes they blow it out of proportion.
Would somebody clarify the communication gap? Because it looks like it's been reverted to what it was previously. And so I'd be interested in hearing.
Well, you get all kinds of opinions on this. You know, but I don't think they tell it like it is. You know, the newspaper.
In what way?
Well, in some cases they don't even tell it. You know, which is bad. And other times it's the extent of the situation which they might blow up. I mean, the whole People's Park issue. It really wasn't the way they said it was. You know. Some things they could have made worse, some things better, probably.
Is that due to intent or incompetence?
No, I think some of it is intent.
So does it vary?
I mean, I've been interviewed, you know, quite a bit in times past with the press. I can remember, I think, two releases out of the last 20 years that I thought were, you know, sort of told it the way it was. It started off when my real revelation on this was when we, in the big war, we made the assault on Africa, and the unit I was with took Casablanca, and we had some correspondents on them. Some of them, I mean, were big names. On one of my ships on Sicily was Mike Kinigo. Some of you may know of him, head of International News Service. But, I mean, these fellows were writing the story on the boat over, you know. And some of the women, they sent us clippings from taking Casablanca. I mean, the headlines were, Armored Infantry Marines Take Casablanca. Now, for an infantryman, that's very bad, especially when the closest Marine was walking post in London. I mean, he wasn't even on the continent of Africa. The armor was out of gas 15 miles away. We marched in. So I lost whatever semblance I had, you know. And I know Time magazine, for example. I mean, they write a beautiful story. But I know I have had some first-hand knowledge of some of the incidents. And they were at a different place than I was.
Things haven't changed since then either. Things haven't changed since then either.
I think his question, you know, is it intent or incompetence? I think it's
some of both. Yeah, it's some of both.
It's a question of both. There's sensationalism, of course, which sells the newspaper, which is an easy straw horse to build up at this point. But I like to hear the nice things too. And I want to, you know, it's nice to hear the things you want to hear, that everything's okay, you know, we can go to bed and relax. And the newspapers, I think, try to accommodate that to some degree, you know, to make us a more peaceful, you know, somber feeling.
Yeah, it's like Chief Justice Warren said, you know, he says, I always turn to the sports page to read about the winners instead of the front page and read about the losers.
Yeah. You know?
Well, I know Newsweek one time, a friend of mine was having a world mission get together in Japan, Tokyo, and this reporter called him from the United States, and the man gave him an outline of what they expected to happen during this week's get together, thinking he was coming over, you know, to report it. The next week he read the full report in Newsweek. The man never showed up. He wrote the entire thing as if he had been there based on this telephone call before it ever happened.
I've noticed how often conversations around here wind up blasting the press. Have you noticed that? The old years, we've had evils in our society, and we wind up blaming the newspaper.
Because there are no pressmen here.
On the question of how accurately the news media report the revolution, is it a revolution or isn't it? You say it's not. I think the situation is much more serious in some areas of the country, some cities, some sectors of cities, than it is in others. It's a highly diverse situation. I think the newspapers exaggerate some minor little incidents that occur in Midwestern colleges, and at the same time do not report, and the consequence of the American public does not understand the extent of the rage in the ghetto, the extent of the rebellion that's about to blow up in the New York high schools, the situation in Oakland, There are areas in this country where I think
high schools in Washington D.C.
where revolution is the only word, and there are other areas where there are other incidents and areas that hit the headlines where I don't think it's a revolution at all, but it looks like.
And that's just the point I was trying to make when we talk about the word revolution. In a society like this, I think it has to. You have to be very careful as to how you're defining the word. This is not a. I really think, in terms of its structure, it's not an ordinary society. That is a structure that is easily overthrown. Because, at least as I have studied political science, the centers of power in this society, in this country, are so diffuse and so pluralistic that when you're talking about revolution, just what are you overthrowing? Where are your locuses of power in this country? You can't really pick centralized courts. You can't even say the federal government. Because there's also power in other sectors. There's power in business. There's power in other institutions. There's power in the church. And there's power in all the different levels of government. And there's power in the agencies. What are you really overthrowing? What are you voting against? What are you going to overthrow? You're going to overthrow the federal bureaucracy? And when you sit in, and so far it's just been piecemeal. There's been no direction to it, because I think we have such a resilient, flexible thing that there's no, it's like hitting a sponge. Your fist gets lost.
Well, and it's an overwhelming power in the newspaper. I mean, not even the president, huh? I mean, he's going to take a chance on getting a bad press, huh?
Maybe without a secret, those powers wouldn't be any good. I'd like to see President Nixon call in his army of 18 and 21 to suppress a common people. Major across the country.
They do it with joy. Yeah. Listen, most of the guys in the army would like nothing better than to go out and shoot a few hundred cops. What they see is the privileged, smart alecky kids who are don't underestimate the degree of patriotism, chauvinism, or whatever in the military.
I'll go along with you on that score. 100%. Well, there was a case, an incident in California in 1965, which I think would clarify the point, Paul, point here. And I never heard about it in papers in the Midwest, and I don't think it reached the East either, where a returning battalion of Marines. Anyway,
Marines are a different.
They're a different breed of man, right? But they're still still these guys. They were similar to my unit in a way that their average age, I imagine, was about 18 and a half or 19. And upon reaching port in San Francisco after being in Vietnam for, I think they were only there for 6 months. It was just after the buildup started, and these guys. A bunch of these college protesters from California, from college, got down there, or maybe they weren't even from college. They were just a bunch of kids running around and waving banners and like, "We're not going to let you off the boat." Well, the battalion commander, being a man of smarts, knowing his military career is based mainly on is really like a political career, based mainly on his name and how he works his way up the ranks, doesn't want to get himself in any hot water, busting up any students. Well, they have in the service what they call a professional private. And this type of individual is very rough, and he's very knowledgeable in the ways of the military, but he doesn't want to accept any responsibility. Thereupon, receiving any rank, he goes out, gets drunk, beats up on somebody, and gets busted. So the battalion commander turned over the battalion to one of his professional privates. And the professional private thereupon told the guys to fall out and steal pots and trenching tools. Then if the dock wasn't cleared within 15 seconds to beat these people profusely upon the head and shoulders, which they would have done with no doubt whatsoever. And I've been in the service, and I've been around these, I've been in many different posts throughout the United States and the Far East, those in Germany was. So, I've had quite a smattering of individual feelings as far as the GI goes, in the service. And these college revolts, the thing that gets them most is just the revolt against the American. Well, anytime the American flag is brought down, burned, or anything like this, if you're doing some of these campus disorders or anything like this, take down the flag, throw it in the ground, or something like this. You can go to any military fort and ask for volunteers, and you got the whole fort right there. These guys are ready to go out and just kick heads. And if they're willing to give them rifles and ammunition, they're willing to go spend it, without a doubt. It's a funny deal, but it seems like after you've been in the service for a while, you get a funny thing they call patriotism, and it kind of sticks with you. You get a funny feeling every time you hear the Star Spangled Banner and things like this. And a lot of this is going on in our society too. And in a way, I can see it because we aren't the forward moving nation moving west. We've hit the Pacific Ocean. We've got no place to go. And this type of patriotism is dead now. We can't have the frontiersman, so to speak, or the guy moving to new horizons in our country. But still, patriotism, I think, as far as the burning of the flag, this is one thing that gets me on a lot of these campus disorders and a raising of, say, the Viet Cong flag or something like this, the North Vietnamese flag. It burns me. It burns me real bad. And as far as the people in the service are concerned, any campus revolt such as this, give them one round of peace, and we won't have any more demonstrators. And that's anybody that's in, I'm sure. I mean, you're going to have your one percentile that's going to be against it. Naturally, you've got your people like this and everything. But the vast, vast, vast majority, they've got this funny thing that they call patriotism. And it's, in a way, anybody, I don't care what you say against the United States, their draft system, I've been in the service, and I say their draft system is about as archaic as you can get. But tear on the flag, and it's going to be me and you all over the mountains of Washington. And that's the way I feel. That's the way these guys in the service feel. They may not go in feeling that way, or maybe everybody's got it deep down in. But when it comes to the so to speak, the nitty gritty, it comes out, and that's one thing I just can't take. And the guys in the service, they can't take it either. Because there's 450,000 of them over in Vietnam right now, hoisting flags and saluting it every morning, not knowing whether they're going to be there in the evening and watch it go down. And they kind of hate to come back and see some college kids running around and tearing it down.
You see, emblem has different meanings for different people. And you see, to me and you, I mean, I'm one of these, you know, I mean, I remember very vividly as a prisoner of war in the Polish quarter, and for some strange reason we convinced the German commandant that on 4th of July 1944 we should be allowed to play the Star Spangled Banner, which we did. And I don't know if there was a dry eye there. Huh? I mean, this has a special meaning to me. Huh? And even today, when you play it, I may shed a tear. And it has many meanings of the people who were the closest friends I'll ever have, who died for what we thought was right. And so it has a very special meaning, you see. But to a student, I mean, to certain of the young black students or something, it means something else. It means injustice is totaling this law, you see, and to them it's something else. And it's the same way with the cross, isn't it? Or Christ, huh? It's two kinds of stone. It's either a cornerstone, in a way, or a stumbling block. And probably basically, this issue is a spiritual one. I mean, we can the Vietnam War can be over tomorrow. We can divert all our space funds into the inner city. But I think the problem will still be there if we do not change the heart of man.
Can the nature of man be changed? If that's the problem. I agree, I think it is.
Well, I've seen quite a few change.
Well, yeah, but the evidence is not very helpful, is it? The world seems to be at great odds.
Man is not very far from either the jungle or the gutter.
Not hopeful if man depends upon himself,
well, it's not hopeful if he depends on something else, too, if he doesn't start depending on it. That doesn't seem to be happening.
But despair, despair is a great sin.
Right. Because free us from that as well, then.
Because then we need to be
there. There aren't too many societies in the world today, though, that would take this government and its energies and defend the right to protest. It's always good to keep in mind.
Yes, we have. We have in a department in which I am, we have a professor from Strasbourg. University of Strasbourg. He's an outstanding research worker. And he and his wife, we're in a discussion group. And he says, you people, you feel so guilty about your problems of segregation, you know. Boy, you ought to be in Europe.
But, you know, that bothers me because it is true that our government and institutions allow more protest probably than other governments and institutions, that the evils of our society can be topped by the evils in other societies. And yet this may dare never become an excuse for inaction or self-congratulation because our ideals are greater, too. And the... I think you can talk to our young people and say, what are you revolting against? You got it better than anybody else. But we have held before them greater visions than other people have had held before them. And we turn to our blacks and say, well, look at how the people in Africa live. You should be glad your ancestors were brought over here as slaves. You're a lot better off than the descendants of the people who enslaved your ancestors. But this seems to me to be, in a way, quite irrelevant.
Irrelevant to what?
Irrelevant to what we ought to do.
Yeah, but we shouldn't spend all our time saying, probably listing all our sins, but getting out here and doing something about it.
Yeah, but just so we don't indulge in an orgy of self-congratulation.
That's right.
Well, what do you mean when you say, you know, things got to be relevant? I just slid past that magic age of 30, and I feel that I've been accused of the issue of student revolt in some of our countries is based on the issue of morality. And I'm part now already automatically at my age into the generation that has caused this problem that has brought to my to the morality issue. How can I become relevant in working this thing out? You know, I'm not comparing with anybody else, but I'm figuring this me. The issue of morality of this thing to be relevant, whether it be in the school, whether it be in the church, you know, or in a relationship with anybody of any age. This is a dilemma I'm in, you know, how do we get around this, you know? That's a segregated issue, you know, between the age of morality, the ethics of our situation. And we had an analysis of patriotism for the flag, and yet I know some students who burn a flag saying, we want to burn it so that these guys don't have to go up there and raise that flag and worry about whether they're going to make it back that night. We want to get them out. The morality of that. You know,
we see things from the morality issue. I wonder, how can we come to a moral society that is relevant in all our endeavors? This is my real problem.
I wish discussion of this type could be held without ever using the word freedom of expression and relevance, because every time the free expression is used, seems to me it sort of creates a sort of general mind and father and quite able to penetrate it.
You have a very simple solution. Wipe out everybody over 30 and let us take over.
God.
Have fun.
See me when you get to be 29, 11 twelfths.
Well, one thing, I wish that the psychologist point hadn't been slammed down so fast, because I think that there's one very important thing that those of us who are over 30 need to notice. I was much impressed by a little book once that I read by Edgar Friedenberg called The Vanishing Adolescent, and I've seen since then much to confirm it, that perhaps that this is a society which fears the adolescent. It has an extraordinary fear of him. And I think it's become paranoid. There are an awful lot of people our age, my age, who, when they see a kid, when they see any adolescent, they become frightened. He's not like us. He doesn't accept our values. He thinks he knows something we don't know. He's a smart aleck. He's dressing that way and wearing his hair that way just to pretend that he's better than me. But he's not. And I think we are in real danger of destroying something, destroying our society, destroying our kids, unless they destroy us, and provoking a war of the generations. If we don't learn, if we don't overcome this paranoia toward adolescence, I think it comes out in some of the discussions here.
You can postpone this conflict and drag it out for 10 years. Adolescents will all be 30 themselves and have the problem of
working
on
it for them. I don't think that's going to... An adolescent is somebody who... He's finding himself. He's searching for an identity. And we think we have values in terms of which he ought to create his identity. If we don't think that, then I feel sorry for us. Then we don't think we have values worth valuing. But we are too eager to impose those values in a very specific form upon adolescents, and too eager to decide, too, whether they really are conforming to what we consider the noblest and the highest. We're not willing to roll with the adolescent a little bit. We're not willing to take some guff from them. Adolescence is a time of protest, of rebellion, when a young person finds himself, and this can sound terribly condescending. I don't mean it to sound condescending. I think we have a lot to learn from adolescents. They do shake us up and keep us young and alive and restore and refurbish our values. We do tend to settle down into ruts, and we don't have to choose between accepting everything they say and do and are and rejecting them totally. There's something in between. And I'm afraid that our society has forgotten this thing.
No, I think you bring up a very important point. I mean, it's sometimes wrong to be right. You know, I mean, you can hit people over the head with it, and that's the end of it. The wall is built.
Well, I just couldn't agree with you more in this. You said earlier that rebellion is contagious, and you know that's perchance true. But even more so, I think for adolescents, it's really necessary in becoming a person. And yet, the adolescents that I don't like that word so much, but the young people that I talk with,
don't so much want adults to agree with them as to listen to them. And so I'll be very interested to hear what you have to say about the art of listening, because it's not easy. And if they say something with which we disagree, in our own defensiveness, we're prone to just really put them down before letting them finish the sentence.
Yeah, or as my kids say, I give them the whole load of hay, you know.
No, on the other hand, though, what dismays me quite often about the older generation in the sense is that they're all too willing, many of them, particularly liberals, to apologize for us. And I find that pretty nauseating sometimes. So we had Dick Gregory come to our school once and say that we, the young, are going to be the saviors of the society, catalog the ills and hypocrisies of the society that stands. And now it's on your shoulders. It's the only morally pure generation in our history. It's up to you to regenerate this, because you're the only ones that are pure. You're the only ones that are honest. And I don't know, I've just graduated from college now, and my past 4 years at school, I've been rather active in student politics and in observing how we actually behave. And I find what's sometimes dismaying me is that we are no better morally, I think, as a generation than our parents were. We are just as hypocritical. There are a few things I am proud of what we have done, but in terms of our actual action, I think, for instance, if you read the Walker Report on the riots in Chicago, and this in a sense is seen as a lot of people, it's the big cleavage of the generation gap. The pigs, the cops, beating up on poor innocent children, or vice versa, youth regarding us as, but I think a reading of that will indicate that there was hardly any difference in the behavior of the two groups, that you couldn't pick who was good, who was bad, who was acting righteously, who was acting justly. There was so much on both sides, so much. It was impossible to choose, you know, between a rabid hippie throwing excrement at a policeman or a policeman clubbing the same hippie with a billy club. What choice is there between this sort of thing? And we talk so much about honesty and integrity, about how we're going to make this world honest, and yet we're judging ourselves by our rhetoric and our elders by their deeds. And there's always, I think, a difference between action and deeds naturally, except we just haven't applied this to ourselves, because we haven't been around long enough to judge our deeds, or we haven't done anything yet. And it sometimes scares me to hear elder people say, yes, flagellate themselves with our accusations and agree with them. I think we're getting away with too much.
Not in California, they voted out all the money.
No, I don't mean, I know. I don't mean getting away with too much in terms of action, repression. I mean getting away with too much in letting us think so sloppily, continue to think this way.
Well, I'd like to have you in my class.
Well, I feel that way too. Where does the parent come in? Now, I think it begins with a child respecting the parent and authority.
Yeah, but the parent doesn't have the only influence.
No,
on the
not
child.
The only, but I mean, the parent is left out completely. Now, where does the parent come in? I'll say for the adolescent, for instance. Our girls are past the adolescent. We didn't have the problem, but where the parent starts right at the bottom.
Right.
And I
tolerance for the parents,
it
doesn't matter
to you. Well, that's the point I mean. Now, where does the parent come in? I think the child loses respect for the parent to begin with, and then it keeps going up. And finally, when they get to college, they have no respect for anyone.
Why are you so angry?
unconditioned by the thought of too many adults.
Well, I get the feeling that you keep seeing enemies wherever you look.
I don't like kind discussions because nobody says anything to their enemies.
You don't.
There's no volition.
That's wisdom, huh?
This is, I don't...
You don't know what you are.
I know what I am.
You do.
I have a very simple anxiety. And I just assume be left alone. Or with a few people my own age or some older people who really know how to talk to each other. Maybe that's idealistic, but it's all right.
I'd like to talk about myself as a student, because I don't think the students here are talking about themselves and not the students.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You just go through the motions or high school, start high school, work up. In high school, the way you get by in high school is you just fall into this little rut and you just go along and you don't go too much to either side of this little rut and nobody passes. It's just the easiest way through and you never stop to ask yourself why you're doing it like this. You just go along little things will happen, but you never stop to think about them. You never stop to ask yourself why. One example might be the president of the student body. Top 10% of his class. The administration won't let him march in the graduation ceremony because his hair is over his ears. And this happens. And it's little things like this that the students don't stop to think about. They don't stop to ask themselves why. And this was the same way with me. I got into college. What for, I don't know. When I got in for a year and a half, I didn't know why I was there. I never stopped to ask myself why I was there. After a year and a half, I stopped and I said, why are you here? And I said, well, I'm here to get an education. And so I set about from there to get an actual education. What I myself define as an education. But it seemed as though the university wasn't interested at all in whether or not I was getting an education. The administration was more interested in whether or not there were stains in my dorm room or holes in my window screens or other trivia. They're concerned about whether they get their money on time. Just plain trivia. The faculty is interested in how wide the margins are on their required papers or which corner you put your name in or something like this. This is what the faculty and myself, I looked at all this and I just became really disillusioned with this whole game that the university insisted on calling an education. And I just became fed up. I can only look down it with bitterness, really.
What do you define an education as?
Well, the university will try to tell you that education is getting the grades, not in those words, but it's all centers on the value of the grade, which I think is pushed way too high. They say, the grades are just like coupons. You enlist, you enroll in a class, and you get your grade. And then after 4 years, you cash in all these little coupons for one big coupon, you see. Now you can go out and get your job and and your $20,000 a year, and your color TV, and your six pack of beer. See, that's success, American middle class success. And so I, somewhere along the line, I just got fed up with that whole concept, and I decided that an education, for me, was anything that I could do to make learning a meaningful experience to me. And what the university was trying to do for me wasn't a meaningful learning experience. And like, I don't know, Paul, you were talking earlier about when a teacher gets up in class and starts reading something, and it doesn't make sense, it's ridiculous stuff, and it's, why are you reading that, And I actually did that once, and I didn't actually say it like that, but a variation. It was a signed paper, and I just interpreted it as simply a regurgitation of facts from one piece of paper that you transpose on another piece of paper. And as long as you got your name in the right corner, you can do it and you get your page. And I just said to him, I just wrote on the paper, that's ridiculous, That isn't education at all. And I don't know how he reacted to it, because, it's right at the end of the quarter, I didn't get a chance to talk to him about it, but...
Weren't there any bright spots? Didn't you have
in the university?
One good teacher?
Oh, yeah, there's good teachers, but education is too structured, I think. People think that you have to have grades to have an education, that you need the grade. If you get an F, you don't learn anything. If you get an A, you learn most everything. And this is all what it is. When I go into class, I say to myself, well, I say test. I refuse to study for tests because I learned very little from taking a test. An examination isn't a meaningful learning experience. Therefore, I don't involve myself with that. You see? But then the university will tell you have to take the examination because you have to get the grade. Otherwise, we're not going to let you go to this university because you have to fulfill these minimum requirements to stay in this. Playing their game of education.
Well, Bob, how else can a university evaluate your competency?
Why should they have? Well, that is an education.
Well, because I think that is an education. When you get out in the world earning a living, your competency is going to be evaluated constantly.
Oh,
in whatever kind of job you're in. It may not be A, B, C, and D, but it's going to be evaluated.
Education is what kind of job you're in and what kind of occupation you're going to get once you graduate.
Well,
you
but I mean...
vocational school or something like that, if you want to work it like that.
But why do you mind being evaluated?
I can't say that I'm really violently opposed to being evaluated. It's the rule of the Almighty, It's what makes the university is the evaluation. That learning, as far as the university is concerned, is the evaluation.
Well, find one man here who's ever gotten a paycheck and ask him if he hasn't gone through the same thing every day in his work.
This is an occupation which, you exchange your service for something and you get money.
Oh, but college is supposed to be a preparation for occupation.
School isn't a preparation for occupation. That's where you're wrong. That's what you could think. But my conception of a university is